We get things underway here in the second hour, though, by welcoming to the show talented actor, comedian, producer, writer, director. You know him from films like Stripes, Coneheads, of course, Strange Brew, television shows including Grace Under Fire, How I Met Your Mother, Bones, an original cast member of SCTV. Joining us, I believe, live from Mellonville on Channel 6, Dave Thomas with us. Dave, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, it's good to have you along this afternoon. I want to talk about a lot of things, but let's go back to the beginning, not the universe, but your beginning. You lived in a lot of places as a young man, North Carolina, Scotland, Wales, England. Did that impact your sense of humor? Did you use that to help yourself fit in new surroundings?
Well, it gave me an ability to do dialects and such, you know, because moving around as a kid, you're kind of impressionable. And you're in Scotland, you hear the Scottish dialect and how it rolls and how it works. And when you're in Wales, you hear, well, then, boy, Bach, how are you? And beautiful to see you here by the... and then down south, you know, we had our own kind of rhythms in Durham, North Carolina. And so, yeah, it affected me. I mean, I was always affected by speech and any character stuff that I ever did. I usually started with a voice. And that comes from my childhood, I think, of moving around.
I saw an interview once, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but you said something along the lines that normal people can't always be that funny.
I think what I said was that being funny isn't a talent. It's a condition. It's a disorder.
Right.
And people who are funny are usually screwed up in some way from childhood, usually in adolescence, you know, and most of the people I know who I thought were really funny had problems in their teens. And I, too, had problems in my teens. So, yeah, I guess, you know, it's being funny is a defensive mechanism. If you can make people laugh, you got a little bit of control of the room for a minute and gives you a chance to kind of cover things.
I know all funny people have a lot of influences too. I know Mad Magazine was a big influence for you.
Yeah. Those I got to know some of those writers when I came out to California, and they were my idols as a kid. I used to read their parodies of television shows and things like that, and then I was tremendously honored when they did a parody of Grace Under Fire. So Mad Magazine parodied me, and I got drawn by their great artists, and it was pretty wonderful. But yeah, I was definitely influenced by Monty Python, by Mad Magazine, by the National Lampoon, by Peter Sellers and Jonathan Winters and Andy Griffith, just so many different comedians that played a part in my sort of comedy development, I guess you might say. I don't know.
I read something where you said you didn't do plays when you were in high school, but you knew even then that you wanted to be on television.
Yeah, I didn't want to be in a play of Life with Father where I'm wearing a white wig and pretending to be a 60-year-old guy when I was like 15. I wanted to be on real television, and I knew I had to wait, you know. So I didn't even try out for plays when I was in high school. I didn't want to be in plays. When I got to university, when I got to McMaster, that was different because I met Marty Short and Eugene Levy. And we were able to do plays that were kind of in our own bailiwick, you know, and we had a lot of fun.
And was it there? Was it in college that you made the underappreciated masterpiece, The Columbus of Sex?
No, I didn't do that.
You didn't?
That was Ivan Reitman. That was Ivan Reitman.
Oh, but were you in it, though?
Nope.
Oh, okay. I thought you were.
No, Ivan did that. And then he got I don't think he was arrested, but the film was confiscated by the Mounties. So, you know, yeah. But there was no film school or no theater school or no television school at McMaster. All of that that I did with these guys, Marty Short, Eugene Levy, Ivan Reitman, it was all extracurricular. It was all funded by the student union, and it was on a shoestring, you know.
How did you get involved in the touring company of Godspell, which was an all-star team of talented performers?
It wasn't a touring company. It was a resident company in Toronto. And it opened first in New York, and then the producers decided to open a company in Toronto. And they put a cast together. And I wasn't in the first cast they put together, which was Victor Garber, Gilda Radner, Martin Short, Eugene Levy, Jane Eastwood, Andrea Martin, Jerry Salzberg. I was in that cast with Eugene and Andrea, and halfway through the run when they had a couple of cast replacements. And so, yeah, that was my first real professional gig in showbiz, you know.
But you decided to, after school, to pursue work in the advertising world, and you got on board with McCann Erickson, ended up getting a Coca-Cola account in Canada, and that went so well, if I remember the story right, that you ended up going to New York and working with the legendary Bill Backer, who a lot of people think might have been the role model for Don Draper on Mad Men.
Yeah, that's true. He was. He was the guy who created that "I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing" mountaintop commercial for Coca-Cola. He was a very unusual little guy, and wore a little gray suit and a little bow tie, and he called me down to New York because he liked a couple of the spots that I did for Coca-Cola for Canada, for Coca-Cola Canada. But he saw them and he said, "Yeah, I want to meet that guy." So they flew me down to New York. I walked into his office on Lexington. It wasn't on Madison Avenue. It was on Lex. And it was a beautiful corner office with a grand piano and a Persian rug and everything. And he was sitting on a sofa just kind of by himself. And I sat down and he started talking. And he started quoting Shakespeare. And I was really just 2 years out of college where I had taken Shakespeare as a major. And I didn't understand why he was quoting Shakespeare. But I thought, all right, well, if that's the game, I'll quote it back to you. So I started quoting Shakespeare back to him. Well, I became the golden boy just because I could do that. That was so strange to win somebody's favor over just by your ability to rhyme off stanzas in iambic pentameter, you know. It was pretty unusual.
And you were doing well in the advertising world, but you walked away from a pretty good income to make, $145 a week in Second City?
Yeah, you've done your research. That's exactly what they offered me. And it was a real step down. And I remember the president of Interpublic, which owned McCann, a guy by the name of Jim Reeves, called me into his office when I said I was leaving and going to do Second City. And he said, "How much are you being paid for that?" And I told him, and he was like, "God." He said, "Why are you doing this?" I said, "Because I really want to do it." He said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. We'll hold your job for you for a year and go get this out of your system. And when you come back, we'll start you at this salary, and you can go back to New York and work with Bill." I think Bill Backer had called him. And so I had a safety net for my first year in Second City. Even though I was making $145 a week, I knew I could go back to a bigger salary if it didn't work out.
Well, it certainly worked out. And then around that same time, Lorne Michaels began raiding the Chicago Second City group and pulling in those people to do what became Saturday Night Live. Was SCTV a response to that in some way?
Yeah. I mean, the owners of Second City, Bernie Sellens and Andrew Alexander, saw their cast being pirated by Lorne for this new sketch comedy show. So they decided to do their own sketch comedy show, which wasn't a great idea because there already was one on now. And so then you go to the networks and say, how would you like another sketch comedy show? So it made it a bit of a hard sell. But they did it, and it was originally on global television in Canada, a real shoestring budget, and 48 syndicated markets with Filmways was the syndicator in the U.S., who also syndicated the Beverly Hillbillies. You remember Ellie Mae saying, "This has been a Filmways presentation" at the end of the show. So, but then Brandon Tartikoff, who was at NBC, after some of the cast, Chevy Chase left and there were changes going on in SNL, he was watching SCTV and he put us into all the NBC O&Os, the owned and operated affiliates. And so we went from 48 markets on Filmways to like 300 markets and following Saturday Night Live. And then the next year he offered us a 90-minute show on Fridays on NBC. So, of course, we took that. And then it was just a kind of a rocket ride, you know, with winning Emmys and going to the, getting a Grammy nomination for the McKenzie Brothers album that Rick and I did and making a movie for MGM. It was just, it just seemed like, I was talking to Rick the other day and we were just reminiscing. Actually, it was yesterday. The other day. Yesterday, we were reminiscing about all the limo rides and some of the stuff, that funny stuff that happened on behind the scenes. I had a lot of fun.
We're talking with Dave Thomas on Downtown. Well, I was such a fan of SCTV, and maybe because it was Canadian and because it was on so late at night that those of us who loved it here as young guys felt like we were in this special club. And some of the characters that you created and impersonated were so fantastic. I'd never seen anybody do Bob Hope before. Now, was that something you had done on stage at SCTV before the television show?
No. I had done it kind of joking. I used to have, I could, one of the guys writing for our show was Bill Murray's brother, Brian Doyle Murray.
Right.
And I used to make Brian laugh because I would just do Bob Hope talking about, "Hey, I'm in Vietnam and I'm higher than the DMZ on some of this crazy weed they got." And so he thought that was funny. He said, "You got to do Bob Hope." And I said, "I don't think I could really do him." And he said, you could. So he encouraged me. And the two of us wrote this sketch together for SCTV called the Bob Hope Desert Classic. And it put together two things that we thought were very important to Bob, which was golf and war. So we had Bob doing a golf tournament in the Middle East with, you know, Yasser Arafat and Menachem Begin and people like that golfing and competing with each other, and Bob doing his monologue on, you know, the ninth hole in the Middle East. So anyway, that started me doing the impersonation, and I thank Brian for encouraging me.
Well, and Play It Again, Bob, you and Rick Moranis. I mean, that's just one of the most brilliant pieces of sketch comedy that I can think of. That was so well done.
The weird thing about that particular sketch was that Rick could channel Woody. And by the time he joined the cast, I had done Bob Hope a few times, and I could kind of get into the headspace of Bob Hope and kind of do him in improvising. So Rick and I improvised that Play It Again, Bob into a little micro cassette recorder in the writing room. And we were just making the writers laugh, but we just kept going. And then we realized, oh, we got a piece here. We got a sketch for the show. And so we just took that tape recorder and edited it down to the sketch, but it was basically all there in the tape recorder.
Now, you ended up working with Bob a number of times. You hosted, I think it was his 90th birthday special, among other things. I love the story, and you've told it on other shows, but if you could If you could share the story of when Bob's publicist told you that you needed to go to his house and visit with him, and Bob wasn't sure why you were there.
Okay, just to correct you, I didn't host his 90th. Johnny Carson hosted that. But I was a guest on his 90th birthday, okay, playing Chester Hope, his nephew, made up as Bob and impersonating Bob. Anyway, I was working on Grace Under Fire, which was shot at CBS Radford in the San Fernando Valley, very close to Toluca Lake where Bob lived. And I got a call on the set from Ward Grant, who was Bob's publicist. He said, "Hey, Bob wants you to come over to the house." And it was like, "Hey, Bob Hope wants me to come over to the house. I'm on my way." And so I drove over there, and Ward met me downstairs. He said he's upstairs outside his bedroom in a little makeup area that he had there. So I walked up the stairs, and Bob turns and looks at me. He goes, because I'd seen him before and been at his house, and I knew him. And he looks at me. He goes, "Oh, hi, Dave. What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, Ward said you wanted me to come over." And Bob looks at me. He goes, "Yeah? Well, what do you want?" And well, you don't get into it with a 90-year-old man and say, "Well, you know, Ward said you want me to come over, and now you're saying, what do you want?" I just said to him, "I want to see that picture you got of Patton pissing in the Rhine." Because I'd heard that Bob, in his travels for the troops, had been in Europe, and he had got a hold of this picture of General Patton pissing in the Rhine. Well, when I said that to Hope, he just lit up like a Christmas tree, and he said, "I got that. Here, let me show you." He said, "You know, there were three of these photos." He said, "The Patton family wanted them back, and they got the other two, but I'd never give them this one." And then there was like, right on Bob's wall outside his bedroom, there's this picture of Patton with his thing up, pissing in the Rhine. You know, I was like, holy moly.
And next to a picture of Neil Armstrong?
Oh, yeah. He says, "This is Neil Armstrong. He did my special right after he got back from the moon." And I don't know how many people could say something like that. He was a unique guy.
One of my favorite characters of yours was your Scottish veterinarian. Was that influenced by your mother at all?
Yeah, she was Scottish. And I went to Scotland, you know, and I was fascinated with the dialect. And one of the things I've heard people try to coach people do the Scottish dialect, and the thing they often miss is that it's a song. It's a language that comes from song, Gaelic. And so they'll say, aren't you going to come over today? It'll be, "Are you not going to come over today?" It's a wee song, you know. And you can do the dialect pretty well if you got a musical ear and can pick up the song, because then it's just the intonation on a few words that need to be tweaked. But if you understand the song and if you can go up and down, you can get the dialect really easily, you know. So anyway.
All right. The McKenzie brothers, people may not know this, began because you had to fill some time. Was it a Canadian content clause that meant you needed to do 2 extra minutes for the Canadian version?
It was because the American version had more commercials in the half hour. The Canadian version was 2 minutes longer.
Okay.
So that means we needed 2 minutes of more content for the Canadian version. And CBC, who are the broadcasters for the Canadian version, said they wanted that 2 minutes to be exclusively Canadian. So sarcastically, Rick and I said, "What do you want us to do, put up a map of Canada, wear toques and parkas, drink beer?" And they said, "Yeah, that'd be fine. If you could put a Mountie in it, that'd be even better." So that's what we did.
And then
we had no idea that in trying to do a kind of a joke back at the CBC to put them in their place for their stupid suggestion, that it would be such a breakout hit, you know? I mean, we had no idea.
And with those breakout characters on any kind of a show like that, it's almost like the momentum creates a life of their own, and it just continues to build.
Well, that was certainly true of Bob and Doug, who pushed out to a different audience than SCTV. And part of it was that when we did the album, we had our song, we had Geddy Lee sing on our song. So then we were hitting his fans and the heavy metal crowd, and it was it completely changed the viewership to SCTV, and we were hitting a new audience.
Our sister station WKIT, that Geddy Lee song is still a requested song all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's the highest charting song of Geddy's career.
You know, I forgot that there was somebody there. And you turned, and I heard this other voice, and I thought, he is one hell of a ventriloquist.
He's just
fantastic.
Thank you. You never even see my hand move. That's the crazy part. It was your idea to do the album, right?
My brother's a Canadian musician, and he had a deal with this album company called Anthem. And I said to Rick, we could do an album. We could probably sell it because we're on TV. I mean, we'll be able to promote the album, and that's going to be valuable to the... But anyway, Rick was a DJ, and he understood records better than me. And he said, okay. So when we got the album deal, Rick said, we have to put a song on it. And I said, why? He said, to get airplay. We won't get airplay with a spoken word comedy album. And he was right. And he said, in fact, we need two songs because we need a...
Got to have a B-side, right?
And a B-side, yeah. So we did the song, and Rick knew Geddy Lee from school. And so he just asked Geddy if he would sing on the song. And we literally paid him a 24-bottle case of beer. That was his. And when the record went gold and platinum, Geddy came back and said, I'd like to renegotiate.
Now, you and Rick were not allowed to write the movie Strange Brew because of your contractual arrangement with SCTV.
That's right. So we took some of our record royalties and hired a writer. But that didn't work out because these were improvised characters. All of the 2-minute sketches for Bob and Doug were improvised. So to hand over the franchise to a screenwriter who didn't really know us and have our ear, the first draft wasn't a movie that we wanted to make. But our agents at Creative Artists Agency in LA got the script on a Friday from the writer, and they sent it out immediately because they knew there's a TV station, there's a no-brainer for a low-budget movie for a studio. And they had a deal by Wednesday. Then we had a deal to make a movie that we didn't want to make. And Rick was going to pass. And I said, well, let's rewrite it. And he said, well, they bought that other script. I said, they didn't even read the other script. This is a deal. They're shooting the deal. We can rewrite this and they won't even know. And he said, I don't know. So I started rewriting it on my own. I don't know. I got to page 20 or 30 or something. And Rick came over, and he said, let me see what you got. And I showed it to him. He said, okay, I'm in. We'll do this.
We're talking with Dave Thomas on Downtown. You mentioned Grace Under Fire, big hit series for several years. Was Brett Butler a challenge to work with?
Well, I think you know the answer to that, don't you? Yeah, she was. It's very strange, you know, how... whatever was wrong with her, whatever problems she had, were aggravated by success. You know, people often say, do people become jerks when they become successful? The reality is they don't have a personality transformation. They don't really change. They just become more of what they were. So, you know, it was kind of like that. And that show shot up to number one in the summer. It wasn't beating Home Improvement during the regular year, but during summer reruns where people had already seen Home Improvement, which was in the number one spot, Grace Under Fire hit number one a few times. And when you have a show that's in the top 10 consistently like that, it has an engine and a momentum of its own that'll go for 5 years without get having any ratings at all, you know. You just get off to a good start like that, and that's the engine that carries you for a while.
Now, were you responsible for getting Tom Poston on the show?
Absolutely. They hired a guy to play my dad, and it was the only time I ever had a tantrum on the show. He wasn't a good actor, and I said I'm not coming in. I'm not shooting with this guy. And they said, well, who do you want? And I said, well, and I meant this as an example. I said, well, why don't you get somebody like Tom Poston? And I went in the next day, and Tom's there. And he looks at me and he says, I understand you're the guy that I'm supposed to thank for getting this job. Well, thank you. You know, the two of us became great friends. I loved him. And we had a lot of fun together. I used to ad lib and do things in front of the live audience just to make him laugh.
And I understand the wedding reception for Tom and Suzanne Plachette was a high point in your life, a moment to remember.
It was wonderful. It was at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, and Merv Griffin owned that hotel, and he was friends with Suzanne and Tom, and he donated the ballroom at the Beverly Hilton for the wedding reception. And he also put a band on stage with Jack Sheldon, the famous trumpet player, as the leader. And so anybody who wanted to sing, and this was show business. I was at a table with Don Rickles, Tim Conway, Richard Crenna, Merv Griffin. It was just like 70s heaven. I had such a good time that night. It was, what a fantastic evening.
I have to ask you about a TV movie you did for Fox with a wonderful friend of our show. She was just on a week or so ago, Mr. Foster's Field Trip with Julia Duffy.
Oh, yeah. Julia was on your show?
Yeah, she comes on a lot.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah, she was my love interest in the show. We had to kiss. And, you know, comedians don't usually play love interests at all. That doesn't even really happen. But this was sort of a softer. But anyway, so there was the day of the kiss, I knew there was a little bit of awkwardness between us, you know. And I went up to her and I said, I know why you're worried about this, because you're worried that once you kiss me, you're going to fall in love with me and leave your husband. And it's just going to destroy your life. And I just have to tell you, you got to fight that. We're actors. You got to pretend that it doesn't have an effect on you. And that eased the tension, and Schuster just laughed. And we handled it very well.
You started your own animation studio, Animax. Did you enjoy doing animation?
Ultimately, no. But I'd done every other kind of TV, and I was curious about everything. And when Dan Graney, who was one of the writers on The Simpsons, called me and said he and a partner wanted to form an animation studio, and did I want to go in on it with him? I said, sure, why not? And then after about 2 months, Dan and the other partner got into an argument, and Dan quit. So now it was just me and this guy I didn't know and a bunch of animators going, well, what do we do now? So I had to go out and try to sell animation shows. And I didn't know any of the executives in the animation world, you know, and I had to figure out who they are and figure out how to do that. And the other partner wanted to do corporate stuff. He wanted the animation studio to be more of an ad agency. So that's always a difficult thing when the two partners of a company have different visions for the company. It usually means it's not going to go anywhere. Yeah, but it took 10 years for Animax to kind of implode in on itself.
How did you go, Dave, from being in a guest starring role on Bones to writing for the show and then writing for The Blacklist?
The writing was first.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. Hart Hansen's a friend of mine. I met him at a Little League baseball game where our kids were playing, and we became friends and had coffee. And we were just talking one day, and he said, you know, you have good ideas on dramatic stuff. You should write a Bones episode. And I said, sure, I'd love to do that. He said, just send me 10 unique ways to kill somebody. And if I like one of them, we'll do a script. So I sent him a list by email of unique ways to kill somebody. And one of them he really liked. And I wrote a script and they liked it. And then they said, would you like to work on the show as a consulting producer? And I'd never done that. I'd never worked on somebody else's show before. Mm. And I thought, well, I love this guy. Hart's a great guy. And so I thought, well, this could be fun. So I did it and I had a great time. I had a wonderful time on that show. That was a great show to work on.
And you wrote a book a couple of years back with Max Allen Collins, The Many Lives of Jimmy Layton. There it is right there. Look at that.
See, folks, I'm a shameless promoter. It's available on Amazon for the shockingly low price of $8.99. And it's a quantum mystery. And Max and I got introduced by SpongeBob, Tom Kenny, and a mutual friend. And we were talking on the phone, and Max said, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, I pitch TV shows and write scripts and things like that. Occasionally act, but mostly write. And he said, you ever written any prose? And I said, well, I have, coincidentally. I have an idea that I was thinking of pitching as a TV show, but I thought it was too weird. So I just started writing it as a novel, and then I gave up because I got busy doing other stuff. He said, how much you got? And I said, I think I got 3 chapters. So I sent them to Max, and Max read them, and he said, I really like this. He said, I'll help you get a book agent or a publishing deal, but what I'd really rather do is write it with you. And well, since he'd written over 100 novels and I'd written none, I thought, well, this is a no-brainer. This is a win-win for me to write with a serious novelist. So we started writing it, and we wrote it during COVID. And pretty much all on Zoom and Google Meet, you know. So, it was fun. I really enjoyed that.
I want to talk briefly about your son, too, Harrison, on my favorite TV show that the last few years. He worked for Gus Fring at Los Pollos Hermanos on the wonderful Better Call Saul.
Yes, he did. And got real popular. And I put his picture up on Twitter. I got a very small, I think I got like 14,000 followers or something, a very small Twitter account. And I put Harry's photo with Gus up on there, and I got like more hits than ever before. It was over 1 million impressions, and, you know, and it was just like, holy moly, this show's really popular. So Harry's done a lot of TV as an actor, but he's also right. The two of us sold a script idea to BBC and CBC, which we're currently writing. And I think he's going to write. I think he's going to be a writer as well as a performer.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, Dave, I have been a fan of your work for, well, longer than I care to remember here. It's such a treat for us to get to talk with you here this afternoon. Really appreciate you making some time for us, and we wish you much success with all your future projects.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
That's Dave Thomas with us on Downtown.